The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening and welcome to IMC and our evening on the Dharma of IMC. And so I think you probably don't know who we are, but this is Andrea Fella, my co-teacher here at IMC, and this is Gil Fronsdal, my co-teacher here at IMC. And the two of us are the guiding teachers together for this place. And it's a wonderful place, one of the bright lights of my life, this place could exist in the way it exists. And I originally thought about doing evenings like this. This is the third time, because many years ago we had a board meeting, and one of the board members assumed that I was on salary. And I said, "How could someone on the board, you know, no one gets paid here? So how could someone on the board, you know, think that?" And I realized that we don't explain ourselves very much. So someone could even end up on the board and never heard the explanation, the background of what we're about. So it felt important to, from time to time, to kind of present it so people know. And to do it on a special evening so only people who wanted to come and hear it would hear it. And so welcome and thank you for coming. Just take the really big picture first about where we are in the Buddhist world. There are, one way of looking at worldwide Buddhism is there's two major divisions, what's called, sometimes called the Theravada, the way of the elders, and the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And they roughly divide geographically now, where places like Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, a little bit in Vietnam, belong to the Theravada, and Tibet and China and Japan and Korea belong to the Mahayana. And the teachings are somewhat different between these two big divisions. And within that division, within the Theravada, which we're part of the Theravadan tradition, the southern tradition, we trace our lineage to the teachers, meditation teachers in Burma and Thailand. And some of our founders of our Insight Meditation Movement practice in Thailand, some in Burma, and some in both, and somehow there was a mixture of those two traditions that came together. And then from practicing in Asia in the 60s and early 70s, some of the Westerners who practiced there came back here and started teaching, and started a center in Massachusetts called Insight Meditation Society in 1976. And that was really the seed from which a very large movement arose, not only a Buddhist movement of this insight meditation movement that's all over the country now, but also what we think of as the mindfulness-based stress reduction movement or the secular mindfulness movement that's gotten really big. It also had its genesis on by people who were on the retreat there at the Insight Meditation Society in the late 70s. So it had a big impact on our society and it spread out. It started off very much a meditation tradition. We practiced with meditation teachers in Asia, came back here and continued the same thing, putting on meditation retreats. As it began spreading into communities around here and around the country, people wanted to have a place to come that would support them in their practice outside of retreats, and integrate their practice and, you know, apply it and make it kind of holistic, so their whole life was included. And little bit it became a reinventing the wheel, kind of reinventing a religion in a sense, guided quite a bit by what we saw in Asia. But a lot of us, what we saw in Asia, were retreat centers, not the integrated approach to how living a life as a whole, at least back in the 60s and 70s. And so creating centers like this and, you know, and becoming community meditation centers is kind of a new thing, creative thing, pioneering thing for Theravadan Buddhism. One of the things that makes it very pioneering is that it's lay-centered. If you go to Thailand and Burma, it's monastic-centered. And the usually monks lead the monasteries and the retreat centers. And here, the centers are led, this insight meditation movement is led by lay teachers. There's monastics who have some contact with it and teach sometimes, but it's very lay-based. And some people feel like, well, there's a charisma of monastics. Like, if you're a Buddhist monk or nun, like, you must be living and been meditating all the time and lots of deep meditation and all that. Meditation is a minority practice among monks in Burma and Thailand, surprisingly. Most of the monks hardly meditated or meditated at all. I saw monks spend a lot of time watching TV and smoking cigarettes in Thailand. And they do other things. They involve in community life, they study Buddhism, they do rituals and services for the community, and they do a lot of things, but they're not necessarily, meditation is not necessarily such a big thing. And there was a revival in meditation practice about 100 years ago in Burma, and a little bit later in the 1950s in Thailand. So now we have, but I would say probably 10% of the monastics meditate. So the lay teachers and some of the senior lay practitioners here in the West meditated tons more than a lot of the monks in Asia. So the fact that we don't have robes shouldn't be held against us. Like, we're like lightweight. You know, we don't really get into it. You know, and there are people who treat us as kind of lightweight, and maybe we are. It's kind of nice to be light. I like it. I think of IMC as being kind of Buddhism light in the sense, so the criticism is accurate, because the Buddhist identity is held lightly here. It's not that important that we making people Buddhists or conveying Buddhism per se, but also not apologetic about being Buddhist and teaching Buddhism, so people can take it as they or leave it, but we're happy if people benefit from the practice and the teachings without the B word, take the practice and go home and leave the Buddhism here. That's fine, because it's the practice and the personal change that comes from it and how it makes us better people and better able to contribute to our society. That's one of the important things we're trying to pass on here, not necessarily Buddhism. But for people who like Buddhism, there's a dosage of that here too. So we started here, and our group started in Menlo Park in 1986 or so as a small sitting group. I joined in 1990, and it was asked to be the teacher for the group. And it was about, I remember it being 12 or 15 people who came on Monday night in Palo Alto. They moved from Menlo Park to Palo Alto. And then it slowly grew, and so by 1993, we had moved to a bigger place, the Friends Meeting House. By 1997, we decided to get incorporated as a religious nonprofit so that someday we can have a bigger place of our own. So 24/7, we could create our own environment, our own home. So rather than kind of being renting other people's church space, we had our own home. And I felt very strongly that having our own home allows people to grow and develop in the practice much better, many different more options than we can have if we're just renting one or two nights a week someplace. And also, I was planning to build it big enough so that more people would come and can invite another teacher in so I could leave. Because I had no plans of staying around here. Now I'm here and I'm committed and I love it here. It's one of the great things for my life to be part of this community and teaching here. But that wasn't the original plan. And so we slowly grew. We came here in 2001. And being and having our own place allowed us to develop new programs and also develop a little bit of a Buddhist culture here, where we're certain philosophy and certain Buddhist teachings, values, are at the heart of what we're doing here. And I like to say that for shorthand, I think there's four primary Buddhist values that we hold, and I'll offer a fifth one, which maybe underpins all of them. And so the first is mindfulness. The second is goodwill, kindness, loving kindness. The third is ethics, virtue. And the fourth is generosity. And those are kind of universal values and necessarily Buddhist. So, the fifth one that I hope underlies all of it is the value of liberation, of freedom. That somehow the heart can be set free from all that weighs it down, all that keeps it limited and bound. So the what's in the heart, the, what's beautiful in the heart, can flow freely and peacefully into this world. And so we try to live that way here, and we try to offer teachings that support that. In offering teachings here, or part of the vision I had when we were starting and up planning for this, getting incorporated as a religious nonprofit, was I did have a vision that of a place that could offer a wide variety of programs so that it would meet people's spiritual needs, Buddhist practice needs, or human needs, in the wide array of wide range of people's lives. So that people, you know, we had this idea we'd start a hospice, for example. Because, you know, if you've been involved in Buddhist practice, it's nice to, if you're dying, it's nice to be supported by your Buddhist community and Buddhist practices. We wanted to have a study center so that we can study Buddhism, and for people who wanted to go into more depth into this, into the teachings and the doctrine and things like that. And so the idea was to kind of create a wide range of programs so it meets the needs of people in many phases of life. And with different kind of emphasis in the teaching depending on the phase and the interest and the situation of people's lives. And we've done a fairly good job so far in this, I feel. And now we have a variety of programs. We have programs for different age groups. We have 4 children's programs for different ages. And we're being lobbied for more. And we have neighborhood groups out in the community. We have affinity groups, LGBTQ group. We have groups for people who have disabilities, chronic illness, life-threatening illnesses. We have a women's group that Hillary is very much involved in, starting. And we have sutta studies. We have retreats. We have our own retreat center because that's an important part of our whole tradition is the ability to go on retreats. We have our own retreat center that started about 5 years ago, 3 to 5 years ago. And we have programs where people can kind of study some of the basic things like the basic teachings of the Eightfold Path. And so we have all these things so that people, as they go through and develop and mature in practice, there are something that meets them as they go along. And so they can kind of move from one to the other if they so desire. And a little bit, the approach that we have here, for better or for worse, is to be something for everyone. I think try to be open doors and inclusive of anybody who wants to come and learn and practice, and that's meant kind of a balancing act of having programs that work for people who are brand new, coming off the street and don't know anything, and also having things, programs for people who have been practicing for 20, 30 years and have been Buddhist monastics in Asia and, you know, deeply practiced, and have programs and activities for them so it works for them too. And so I think we've done a relatively good job. I think we're about 10% of the way there to really having something really, some vision I had originally of what we could become and what we could be. To me, it's been very exciting to be part of this because it is a little bit of a privilege to be reinventing a religious tradition here in the West. People often don't realize that. They come here and I'll just say, Buddha said, or this is what Buddhism is, and people assume that they walk into, I don't know what they assume, but pristine original Buddhism, and this is it. But every form of Buddhism comes out of certain culture and cultural conditionings and historical times. Probably every generation within every tradition is changing. What the teachers we studied with in Asia, like when I was there, I thought they were kind of like the old fogies, you know, the old conservative orthodox teachers. Only later, when I studied a little bit up about them and their place in Asian history, they were like the radical progressives in their youth. And then within a generation or two, they kind of became more established. And so, you know, maybe I was a radical progressive in my youth, but now I'm seen as an old fogey now. So we'll need some of you to step forward and, you know, shake things up. But every tradition kind of changes and evolves and has a condition, certain historical conditions in which it exists. And there's no way around that. And so we have our own here. And so we've taken teachings from Asia, practices we learned from our teachers in Asia, and we've adopted them, we've adapted them, we've changed them, we've we've developed them in new ways. Maybe we've moved them in different directions. You know, to a variety of things. Partly kind of bringing together elements of Western culture, which maybe we felt we couldn't avoid having as of being here. And sometimes dropping Asian elements, the cultural elements that we felt didn't belong here, didn't fit for us. So it's an experiment. It's a dynamic activity that we're all kind of creating. It's unfolding as over time. It's been exciting over these 40 years to watch how it changes. And so I have a very clear sense of its contingent nature. It's changing and moving and developing in all kinds of ways. And that I didn't know when I was a new practitioner. I thought that the way it was presented to me was it. So IMC, we offer it in its own historical and cultural context that we hope meets the needs of people in the society. And we're very aware that there's many different kinds of people in our society. And so the question is how to meet that. It's a big question.
I'm also really both, I feel honored and privileged both to be a part of this community. It's, as Gail says, it's a new creation here. And he pointed out that the Western Buddhism really started with the retreat culture. And so what we are doing here is more, the retreat culture is a group of people comes together for a period of time, you know, anywhere from a week to sometimes longer, 3 months or so. And that creates a little community for that time. But then all of those people disperse and go to various places. And there was often, I think, felt a sense that in that dispersal, there was something that people missed about the community, about having a group of people to practice together with. And really that feels to me like what this community is an expression of. It's this wish for people to come together and practice together. And so really I think community here is a big part of what IMC is about, practice in community and exploration of what that means. And this is part of the, you know, Gil says we don't say the B word very much, but we don't. But this is a part of what the Buddha originally created was community of people practicing together and integrating, interfacing with the wider community. And so, looking at community here and how we practice together, how we go inform each other here at IMC. You know, we sit up here as the teachers, and yet I think the way I hold, and I learned this from Gil, so I think probably he holds, I don't know that I can speak completely for you, but the way I hold this role as a teacher is kind of more of a friend, of a spiritual friend, someone who has perhaps more experience than some in the community to offer something to support and learn, but we are learning too. So it's an exchange. We are all practicing together here in this community. We are exploring what it means to be a community that is as diverse as the culture that we live in. And there's some ways in which we all, I think the community and we as teachers need to explore that, explore what it means to be truly inclusive, to recognize that in some ways different cultures, different people and different parts of our society kind of almost have different cultures that are coming together. And so to speak to people where they are, to speak to people in a way that the teachings will be able to be understood. I'm learning, I know that I'm learning a lot about this as I engage in teaching more diverse communities around the country. I'm involved in a program at Spirit Rock, and that's another piece around us as teachers. We are not just teaching here, we're part of a broader teacher community. We teach at Spirit Rock, both of us are on the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. I also teach it at the Insight Meditation Society at the long retreat there each year. And so we're part of a broader community of teachers. So in some ways, we are also held accountable in a broader teacher community. And I teaching at Spirit Rock, I'm involved in a program where there's quite a bit of diversity. And I've learned so much about hidden ways that I express things from my cultural perspective that I wasn't aware of. And so beginning to peel that back and try to become aware of how I speak and what I say and how it lands, how it impacts different people from different cultures. And so that's a piece of our community here and part of the learning that I think we're really exploring. Practicing in community here at IMC, one of the big pieces of that, because of the way we work, the real commitment to the ability to offer the teachings completely freely here, completely freely. No fee, no charge for anything, no expectation of any financial remuneration. To make that work, it takes the community. It's not something we can do without the participation of the entire community. And so the teaching, Gil mentioned the teaching of generosity and that's a foundational teaching of the Buddha. And here it does manifest somewhat in terms of the financial support that people offer either at the door or through donations online. We do have to pay the electric bills, et cetera, here, you know, pay for the facility to be here. Gil and I both receive reimbursement for health coverage. But other than that, we receive the donations that you offer as to us as teachers. And so there's some of that that's a piece of the Dana culture. Dana, the Pali word that means giving, offering, that is intimately connected to this quality of generosity that is cultivated through a heart that wishes to I like to think of generosity as being the heart that wants to nourish what it's inspired by. So that's a piece of what Donna means here at IMC, but I would say the larger piece of what Donna means here at IMC is the fact that we all are in this together, that we make this happen together. There are volunteers for every aspect of how this center operates. The people who manage and help us record, the people who wash the deck. I was out there. People were out there washing the deck when I got here. The people who handle the finances, the people who help us renovate the facility. Everything is done. The people who keep the website together. The people who pick up the chairs to take them to the upholsterer to be upholstered. All of this, that all of it, everything that happens here is dana. Whether it's the financial kind or the offering of time and volunteering. And so this is a big part of how our community functions. And it's truly a practice of community building. And, in some ways, it was interesting when Gil said that we don't talk about this much. And, here we are talking about this to the people who showed up to want to hear about it. People can come here for a very long time and never hear anything about this teaching of this community working in this way. Sometimes people have come and just, sit and just, just assume somebody's funding it or something, and then someday, a year or two in, may think of asking, gee, I wonder how it works here. And then to discover that it's all offered. It's truly in the lineage of the Buddhist tradition to offer this so completely freely. It's radical, actually, in terms of a Western Dharma Center, what Gil has committed to. Most Dharma centers charge some kind of a fee to cover the costs of the building. And Gil, in both this center and in the retreat center that we have, deeply committed to this principle of generosity and dana, with the sense that the practice, our practice of opening the heart, unfolds best with this notion of giving and receiving being a foundation of the practice. That's probably... Do you want to say any more about that?
I think what underpins this idea of... A couple of things that underpins this idea of being a community-based, volunteer-based, donation-based. One of them is what Andrea has said already, that... strong principle is that we're all practicing together. So those of us who are teachers, we're also practitioners, and like everyone else is practitioners. And so the idea is we're all kind of practicing together, and ideally over time our roles would all rotate around. We don't stuck in this way here. And so the idea we're all practicing together, we're all supporting each other, and there's something very important about, I think, about spiritual growth, where people support or nourish the place they practice in. So we're not just consumers of the practice, but we're also producers of it too, and supporting it that way. And in doing so, there are three wonderful attitudes that hopefully infuse what we do here in the community. And that is, first one is goodwill, the second is generosity, and the third is gratitude. And we have this idea that when those three are in place, that they'll create really good conditions within which to open the heart, within which to practice mindfulness, meditation, compassion, within which to kind of explore the Dharma. And I suppose it could be there, that gratitude, goodwill, and generosity can be there in a center where things are paid for and we hire people to do everything. But I think it's kind of very special in our society to come into a place where it's so different economically from what we have out in the wider world. And people can come into kind of a public place and nothing's asked of you in terms of money. And actually, some people find that nothing's very nice to come and sit in the back row, gentleman back there, although as far back as you can get. And, be non-committal, nothing's asked of you, you come and go. And I'm surprised sometimes by the people who say, I've been coming here for 3 or 4 years. And I said, really? Because I've been sitting in the back, and they really like that. It doesn't work so well for people who come the first time and really want to connect, because it's a little bit harder sometimes to connect. But initially, people are friendly. But anyway, the idea of gratitude, goodwill, and generosity are kind of the nourishment for all of us. Sure.
We could probably talk for a long time, but we thought rather than talking at you, we would see, you know, what kinds of questions you might have about how IMC works, about the teachings, pretty much anything. Anything is game here, you know. What are your questions? Yeah, and let's use the mic. So.
It'd be nice if you said your names as well.
I'm Ed Hartle. I have been coming here off and on for a long time, but my primary base is Insight Meditation South Bay.
Is that on?
Okay. Try again.
There we go.
Okay. Is it on now?
Is it the light on?
Green light.
Yeah, it's right on.
Hold it like a ice cream cone.
Yeah, I think it's on.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, great. My name is Ed Hartle. I'm primarily affiliated with Insight Meditation South Bay, but I have been coming here off and on for a long time. I'd like to know more about the volunteering and how all those volunteers are coordinated and organized, and how not all of it, because we only have a few minutes, but roughly how do you manage to oversee the workflow?
Okay, can I say something?
Absolutely.
So there's a lot to be said about this, but to begin by not answering your question directly, and I'll try to answer it. I think that how I've tried to set up IMC, the approach to being here, is that it's an opportunity-based organization, not a needs-based organization. And so we never get a fundraising letter for us saying we need your money because to pay electricity and all these things. But rather, the spirit is more like there's an opportunity to do this great thing here. Offer Dharma, practice opportunities. It's really, well, we have a great opportunity. And if you want to support those opportunities, great. In my heart, behind all that, is I'm prepared for this place to disappear. We're not trying to hold on to this place as for all costs. So, you know, if the support is not there, don't want to support this opportunity, then, you know, it's time to fade away and become something else. And that attitude is supported by my little kind of hokey physics, where I believe in the conservation of goodness. So whatever is good here, or gets concentrated here, it'll spread out and just go spread out. We don't lose that. And so in terms of volunteers then, we have a tremendous pool of volunteers, great people who do things, wonderful, wonderful offerings that our community does. And the art of it is, and this is where it's a little bit tricky and hard to understand, is to have this attitude that it's so wonderful what you offer when you're a volunteer. We appreciate it so much. And we don't really need it. You know, it's okay if it doesn't happen. There's two things we really need to have happen. Someone has to have the key to the front door, or the code. And we have to have a really good treasure. And so everything else, you know, so we don't need to do a newsletter, we don't need to have a website, we don't need to do as many programs as we do, and we're set up financially, so we're never going to be up on the edge financially. That was, from the very beginning, it was part of our approach, was we always have enough money in the bank, so we could go for a couple of years without ever running out of money, because we never want to be kind of out of breath, oh, we have to make money, we have to make the bills. So we have always had this protection from that, so we can stay in a relaxed way. So we try to be relaxed about it all. And this art of really appreciating, hopefully we appreciate people enough here, but also there's a lot of room then for people to kind of come and go in volunteer position. Hopefully they don't feel too much pressure around it. When someone becomes the president of the board, it's a kind of a big responsibility. I think and Liz here is the president of the board now, and I think I told her this. If I didn't, you better listen now. I say that whoever is the president doesn't have to do it like the last president. That it has to do it in a way that works for them, And then if some of the jobs that are usually done by the president they don't want to do or can't do, that they tell us, and then the whole organization will morph around it. Did I say something like that?
I don't remember that. I understood that.
You understood that. That was what I try to tell every president. And so we morph around. And so my hope is that gives the volunteers kind of a relaxed feeling, so it's easier to come forward with the generosity and goodwill without too much feeling of pressure and needing to do things. It means that sometimes we're in the kind of, things are kind of almost not happening. You know, it's like, who's showing up, who's going to do something, and, you know, and for, so some years we won't have anyone who does the website maybe, or some years we don't have something, but you know, the idea is to be relaxed around it. So that's part of it. But we do have an organizational structure that has various states of strength. You know, we have different committees. We have people, the fundraising committee. We have the facilities committee. We have communications kind of committee. And
volunteer.
And what else do we have?
Volunteer
committee.
Yes.
And program committee, kind of. And some of those are self-perpetuating, which people who are in it will find new volunteers to step forward. Some of them, they're not so self-perpetuating, when other people have to be involved in searching for people for it. Sometimes things happen here. People take initiative to do things here, come forward and say, I'd like to do something. Like, I was a little bit surprised today to find out this man was out there on the deck with a power washer. I didn't know our deck was so dirty until he cleaned it today. And I thought, wow, this was filthy. Because it built so slowly over time. So he just figured out on his own initiative that he wanted to do that. And so that was great. So does that answer your question well enough?
I'll add one thing. You know, the opportunistic nature of the what happens here. You know, sometimes people will come and say something like, gee, it would be great if you did such and such. And that... that's great. We love to hear what the community would like. You know, we'd like to hear that. And yet, because every request requires volunteers, often what we will say, if you come saying, gee, it would be great if you did such and such, our response will be, would you like to do it? Would you like to take the initiative to step forward to do it? So that's a part of what Gil means by opportunistic, that the programs that have evolved here have happened because, not so much because Gil and I, some of them have happened because Gil and I wanted to do them. The daily life practice program that I initiated, I started it, and then there was a request for it to continue, so that that kind of grew out of both community and my own interest. But many of the programs here came because somebody stepped forward and said, gee, it would be great to have this, and we say, please, you know, we want to support what the community wants. So that's a piece of the way the culture here works also.
What do you say, Hillary? You said Hillary's our volunteer coordinator. Do you want to say anything or correct anything? Or?
I think you said we didn't really need any volunteers except for the person to open the door and the treasurer. So I would like to give another viewpoint. I actually really appreciate that there are so many people who are willing to offer so generously of their time. And I guess my philosophy is that we, you know, as Gil spoke to, you know, it should be easeful. We want it not to be stressful in any way. And so we try to just have lots of smaller jobs and pools of people and that support each other. And so if you're interested in helping out, you can say hi to me. I'd be happy to meet you.
There's another thing
that occurred.
Let me just follow on something first, something Hillary said. It went in and went out. I'll see if I can retain it. Hmm. seems to have gone.
Son? Okay. My name is Michal, and I'm pretty new. But the first few experiences here have been wonderful, so I really want to thank you for creating this. It's kind of fascinating to hear how this all came about. I guess I have a question, but just a little bit about me to kind of put the context for the question. So I've been coming with my family to the Dharma Sprouts program, and it's been amazing. And I've never heard of anything like it. And the whole family is benefiting from it. And we've been trying to figure out a way to increase our ability to commit and participate as a family, and haven't found a good way to do this. So I'm wondering what your vision for how you would expect new families. My daughters are 4 and 6. How you'd expect or would want to new families to be able to participate in a higher commitment way.
Nice. I appreciate the question a lot. It's something we've thought about quite a bit over the years, and we've tried various things. one of the things that's contingent upon is having people who are willing to step forward to organize programs, right? So we started off in 1997 or something with a once-a-month, half-an-hour children's program for anybody who was a child. And that slowly grew, and then we came here, we started dividing it up. So now we have 4 age groups. And we tried to do a coming-of-age program, but that didn't really get enough traction to make it work here. We thought we had a lot of high hopes for it, but we had a year of it that we tried, but it didn't continue. We'd like to do more, and it's something that works for families. We've thought about it. One of the limitations is location. Our schedule here in the building is pretty packed. And so, for example, having a program during the Sunday morning adult time here, so that where there could be a children's program, the parents and the kids could come together, share the place, do some integration going back and forth, would be a great thing to do. But the building is too small to have 2 programs in the same place. We've canvassed around the neighborhood to look for places that we could rent and borrow or something, but that hasn't really panned out yet for us. So it's a little bit hard to envision a lot without people coming forward with new ideas, and new ideas that are not dependent on this place because of the limitation here now. But Liz has been a key in this for many years, and she started Dharma Sprouts. I guess she's moved. You passed it on, right? Now, are you still involved? Okay.
And she's wonderful.
Do you want to say a few words about answering his question?
Yeah, thank you for asking the question and for your family's participation in Dharma Sprouts. Also, I think you guys are going to participate in the family retreat. So one of the things that we've also done is had an annual family retreat. This is, I think, our 5th year of doing that. And so as your children grow, there will be Dharma Rocks and, you know, Dharma Bodhis, which Hillary has been teaching, and teens. As Gil said, there is some, you know, there has been some thought to offering it on more Sundays. And actually, there is someone, you know, who, as her children grow a little bit older, has expressed a little interest in adding perhaps another Sunday for that first program, Dharma Sprouts. So those are always things we're looking for. And as Gil mentioned, it does depend a bit on the schedule. But, you know, Hillary and I have been pretty successful at fitting things in to the schedule that's here. So those are some of my thoughts. And Hillary, do you have any additional things to say about it?
I think in line with what Andrea said is that it really, if there is enough interest and there are enough families who want to support something and are willing to, you know, be involved in making that happen, then we're, you know, we're open to hearing ideas and exploring that together.
Great, thank you. So, oh, yes.
So about the children, we have a once a month potluck here on Sunday, the last Sunday of the month, and I'd love to have a bunch of 2 and 3 year olds running around, or 5 and 6 year olds, or so. It could be a family potluck too. It doesn't have to be just the old folks who come on Sunday, and that'd just be lovely to have a bunch of families, and bring your friends. You know, you don't know us. We don't know the Dharma Sprouts kids for the most part. The family, the younger families. And you bring some of your friends, and all my friends are already there. So come on. We also have a picnic, a picnic in the summertime, and a lot of people at Red Morton Park, or somewhere like that, and a lot of families come to that. So you could meet other people too.
Okay, this is a comment, sort of like a question, but. Like many, many people, I was introduced to IMC from someplace away through Audio Dharma, and I was new to Buddhism. And for a long while, it just looked to me, I mean, I was wonderfully deluded. It was really just a list of names on the Audio Dharma list. And there, I didn't know who was who. And so it was an incredibly rich experience because I was introduced to so many different teachers and speakers. I came from a peer-led sangha, which is all I knew, so I actually for a while thought, well, wow, they're really great sangha, because, you know, at my sangha, they would rotate people to speak. And so so I guess my question or maybe complaint is I know that someone looking at the website now may not have that experience, and so I'm wondering why the decision was made to not have the full roster of people who speak here on the front page. Of the website.
Full roster of the people.
I thought it was on...
Oh, you mean on the homepage?
If you go on the homepage, you only see... I'm not saying that's...
I understand what you're saying.
It may be a good reason. I just know that I might not have had that experience.
You have to go on Audio Dharma to get the full roster, yeah.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, the way I found it, I might not have done that right. So
I see.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Okay.
And I just also want to know, really, what a good experience. Wonderful confusion it was, actually. It lasted for long enough, and I'm happy now. But
that's been one of the great surprises of IMC. Yeah. So many surprises. One of them is the once we started putting the recordings up on the web, the phenomenal outreach that has, and so many people around the world who've written to us and said they've benefited from it in so many ways. And I didn't see it coming. It was kind of a surprise that, wow.
This is almost a pilgrimage place for some people, you know. People come from all over the world, actually.
Yeah.
I've seen people come up, and they come in almost starstruck. You know, this is where Audio Dharma happens.
Yeah. I mean, maybe only a really lonely person would do that, but I mean, I came to IRC, and I was like, I knew like 7 or 8 of the people there.
You were not alone. You're not alone. Yeah.
And say your name.
Yeah, this is Gus Pinto. Can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned about 10% of your vision, kind of joking around, I think. But my question revolves around, and you said 40 years of doing this. Where are we 40 years from now? What's the vision of going forward? We've talked a lot about how we got here and how things work right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about what is some vision of what it might be.
Uh-huh. I have no shortage of vision. So that's, you know, I can talk about that. But I think that part of the vision is to create here in the peninsula a full Buddhist culture so people are interested in that, could have their life well integrated, all the different aspects of their life connected, integrated, informed by. Not that they have to be Buddhist or even connected always to everything to Buddhism, but there are people who want to have their children, for example, connected to their spiritual tradition. People who, like I said earlier, want to die and have some support. They want to get married and they want to have support. People who want to study the doctrine, the history, the scriptures, and do it in some deep way. People who want to develop a strong sense of community and spiritual friendships. People who want to explore all kinds of different areas of their life. So I think to develop a much more stronger, robust program and part of that, too, as we're developing currently, is a whole series of multi-month programs, like year-long programs, that are kind of graduated. So someone would come here and do the intro to meditation class, then they might do the Eightfold Path program, the Seven Factors Awakening program, and we would have a series of programs that people can explore and develop different aspects. Maybe someday we'll have a parenting group right now, and maybe someday we'll have a parenting program, has a curriculum and explore. And so one of the visions I have is to have a study center, a place that offers, you can go to take classes like you would at a seminary. Now both for practitioners who are really serious about the practice and serious about the study, but also a place to train like the next generation of teachers. And so to have a place, IMC would have a wide enough a range of programs that we were also training the next generation of teachers who come out of here, coming through here and out of there, if those people who want. I mentioned a hospice. I think that a really important thing I'd like to see happen here is a strong service component in the community and support the wider community, and both here locally, maybe much more widely. We started with something more widely in an organization we started a few years ago called Insight World Aid, and we did as much as we did one medical mission to Cambodia, but then it kind of began to fall apart. It was too complicated to keep it all together. But sitting there, on the shelf, this nonprofit, Insight World Aid, and I'm hoping that someday we'll come out of hibernation. And I've been wanting to see more active involvement of our community for a long time, but I'm stretched as thin as I can. And there haven't been really strong efforts to kind of build it up. But there are some movements happening now, and we do a variety of things that are very nice for our community. But I think they're kind of still on a small scale. And as we get bigger, I think as we become a bigger and larger organization, we're also citizens of our community. And so not just to be isolated from it, and what that exchange is and how that involvement is something I hope will develop over time. So those are some of those things.
Could you talk about the chaplaincy?
I'll say a few words first. I could say a few words.
Yeah, please. Yeah, we don't forget.
So a couple of pieces. One, Gil mentioned a study center, and that is one of the pieces of the vision that is functioning to some extent. The Sati Center was Gil's vision, and that has expanded now to the Sati Institute for Buddhist
studies.
Theravada studies.
Yeah, Theravada,
I knew it was SITS. Sati Institute for Theravada Studies, that's in conjunction with the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And so some of that is happening. The study center piece of it is active, unlike the Insight World Aid. I think one of and the chaplaincy program is a piece of that part of IMC. That one of the limitations at this point, the opportunities are limited now, at least in my experience and in the teaching here, the opportunities are limited by the size of the building. And we're pretty much full here, and so one of my visions would be that we could find another place, maybe another place in this neighborhood or a bigger place that had multiple rooms where multiple programs could happen simultaneously. That would be just amazing if that could be a possibility. Then some of these visions could really come to fruition. It's amazing what's happening here with the space that we have. And, you know, just I do have visions for things that could happen if we had more space. So that is a piece of opportunity. I mean, we are opportunity-driven, but that's a piece of opportunity that is a little limiting at this point.
Another piece of, you know, vision we're slowly kind of trying to develop is a strong online offering of courses and programs. So we offer a lot here, and I think we can package some of these things together now and offer things online. And to be able to have the Dharma talks, you know, streamed live for people would be nice. And so we have plans and ideas and little teeny steps to try to develop this, but you know, some of that needs a lot of volunteers who are not here yet. So we're waiting for that. And then the chaplaincy program. So we had the study center, the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies, that started in 1997. And we did a lot of wonderful programs, and we still do. But then after 9/11 in 2001, I kind of was sitting around saying, you know, it's not good enough just to offer classes on Buddhist studies and Buddhist scriptures and, you know, removed from the world we live in. And we should do something that kind of really directly kind of more involved with our society in a good way. And so out of that kind of thought came a year-long training in Buddhist chaplaincy. And it's a wonderful introduction to spiritual caregiving skills, especially for people who want to be volunteers, chaplains in hospitals or in prisons, or moving on to become professional chaplains. And one of the really wonderful things is that over these now 15 years or so, that in this room, we have trained probably 200, at least 200, maybe more, probably more, people to be Buddhist chaplains. And almost every hospital in the Bay Area has had our people either working there or volunteering there. And now we have this very good reputation in the Bay Area. When people hear that that they studied with us, you know, it's like on the resume, like, you know, you know, they get hired quickly. Yes, please, take the mic.
Thank you. My name is Jess. The question I have is about IMC in relation to the tech boom, and particularly the kind of, you mentioned it earlier, but the sort of explosion of mindfulness in technology, and the sort of strangeness of that as a kind of cultural thing. I don't quite have the language for it, but I wondered if you both see IMC as adding to that directly, or as in dialogue with it, or as something that is completely removed. And I'm just very curious.
Great question.
I'll think about... I wouldn't say it's completely removed. You know, certainly I think that the whole secular mindfulness movement, as Gil mentioned earlier, really, I think, had its genesis with the mindfulness-based stress reduction. And John Kabat-Zinn, who founded that movement, was trained at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And so the whole movement, I think, was born with the really solid foundation of the training of mindfulness that came from this tradition. I would say that, you know, we're not actively out there in the community in that way, with maybe one exception in the prisons.
Yeah, we do some work in the prisons. And lately we started to offer meditation in the jails.
Secular meditation in the mail, rather than...
Secular, I guess it's kind of sacred. I don't know.
Well, that was
maybe it is.
Yeah, that was my impression. But most of what we do directly here, we do have the we reserve the right to use the Buddha word. And so I myself, you know, I would prefer, you know, to not go into those contexts, because it takes a different language to speak in the secular context, and I'm so thoroughly in love with what the Buddha had to say, and am not apologetic for that he said it. I don't think there's a direct connection there. We're not out in the community doing that. Is there more?
We try to be responsive to requests when they come. So we had requests in a variety of businesses around someone to come and do some kind of teaching of mindfulness. And if there's people here available, then we recommend them, and that's worked out fine. We've had people, companies come here sometimes to do little programs here. We had the creativity group from Netflix come here, and I did a little program with them. We've had some of the tech leaders of the tech community kind of interface with us in various ways over time, a little bit. But if people come to us and ask and request, and then we try to accommodate. One of the nice things is schools. A lot of schools have come here. And we've had school programs that come here, and we do little things with the middle school or high school. And sometimes I've gone to high schools to speak to groups there.
And again, the two of the big programs, two of the big mindfulness in education, and another one, I can't remember the name of the other one, were both founded by people who came from this lineage. Yeah. One of the key players in this area of mindfulness in education did her first meditation class here, and is now in the teacher training at.
In the first national conference on mindfulness education was planned in that conference room. They've got a little, you know. So we're out. But in terms of the tech boom and the tech groups itself, so we're responsive and happy to offer support. You know, if it works, if we have time and ability to do it. But there's something we're a little different also, because Buddhism is also a little bit subversive. And so, you know, we're not completely, you know, in harmony with what's going on with capitalism and, or, you know, industry and productivity and, you know, so exactly when the subversive side gets emphasized, or, you know, but usually we don't talk about it so much, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we don't have to tell people, but some people who come into the Buddhist field, their values begin to change and they can't sometimes do the same work anymore, and some people become downwardly mobile, and and different things. So I hope that in our quiet, non-obvious ways, we're a healthy subversive movement for our society and for the tech world.
Let me just say the obvious. I mean, most tech companies want mindfulness training so they can work their employers harder without them complaining. And I'm sure you know that. Everyone knows that. And it's kind of a sore point. And I'm very glad this is a Buddhist center.
And behind you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Anne. I think it's beautiful, the things you're describing. And I think a lot of meditation places, I had my experience in another Dharma center where you did hospice work. I think it's something you can do. Anyway, but I think all the things you're describing really are beautiful. But in part of my mind, I was part of a Dharma center where people were very much in demand because we had things that could help people. And this is a question for both of you. Do you have a side of you that thinks, okay, let's not go over the edge, let's not do too much and get real, like running on empty, you know? Do you feel that way, or how are you thinking about it? Do you understand what I mean?
Do you mean in terms of us personally or the center as a whole?
I was thinking of both, but seeing as you're the leaders, I mean, I watched some people in Dharma leadership, you know, a variety of people within a community just, they were kind of running on empty. There was so much demand for what they could do, and they felt happy to serve other people. But the demand kept coming and coming, you know.
This is certainly an issue in terms of that there is that demand, and it's at least as a Dharma teacher, you know, it's interesting the life of a Dharma teacher. We teach here in community, but also on retreat, and the retreat schedules are set years in advance. So you know, I know what I'm doing in June 2018. You know. And so those schedules get set, and it's easy to what one teacher recently who co-taught the March retreat at Spirit Rock with me said, well, my 2014 self thought this was a really good idea. And so it's a little hard to plan out that far. And so it's a challenge. It is the life of a Dharma teacher it is a challenge in that way, and I'm learning that, and I think Gil is further ahead of the curve in that way than I am. But in terms of the community, I think, not running on empty as a community, it's exactly what we talked about, that we try not to overcommit things. We're very careful to look at, do we have the volunteers to do something if somebody brings up an idea? You know, this is a huge concern of ours. We'd love, for instance, at the Insight Retreat Center to offer month-long retreats. And this is something that we're not sure that the volunteer support is quite there for yet. You know, that so we're really careful about that. We think about that a lot. You know, and even having a bigger building, as Gil said, you know, that would take a lot more volunteers. And so, you know, the fact that we haven't found something, it doesn't mean that we're stopping looking. In some ways, it seems to magically work that we get just what we need when we need it.
When we really need it, not when we want
yeah.
it.
Yeah, when we that's right.
So, you know, if suddenly someone wanted to give us a bigger building, I'm not sure I'm ready to the move because of that issue. We have to be careful not to stretch our community. Do we make sure we have the resources for it all? So, in some ways I'm content with what we have. We tried some years ago, about 10 years ago, to stop growth. That didn't work. So no more program, nothing new. And that didn't work out. But now we're constrained by the building. But now we're trying to do online things, so that's limited. And then also, you know, in terms of one of the protections from being stressed, I think, is this Dana system. Because if I got paid, I'd feel like I have to do a good job. and so now I do the best job I can, for sure. But I feel like, you know, it's I could show up here and, you know, I don't have a Dharma talk. I don't feel like giving one. I can just sit down and just say, okay, today we're doing questions and answers. If you have any questions for me, I'll try to answer. And that's a protection for me from, you know, because I don't, you know, so I don't have to kind of feel like I'm up, you know, past midnight writing a Dharma talk or something. Make sense?
Yeah.
So I think the Dana system is a great system for on many, many fronts.
So at one time, I heard you address this issue of getting bigger. Your idea then was, let's spin out a bunch of small places. And now it seems like, have you changed your view on that?
Yes and no. I think that at various times in our growth, I didn't want us to grow bigger. I wanted to do more. So, like in Palo Alto days, we were Monday night only, and we got to be really packed. I mean, like to be like 100, 120 people came, and then people said, "Well, we should move to a bigger place so more people can come. There's space for people," and I said, "No, the dynamics would be too weird. We have bigger group and." The amount of projections onto the teacher and the amount of conceit the teacher can have, me, in other words. They have all these people come sitting there. I didn't think it was healthy for me and for our community. So rather than doing one bigger group, we started a second group on Thursday night and then a third group. And so I ended up kind of doing all these teachings and it was more efficient just to teach in one place, right? But I wanted to keep it kind of small and smaller. Over the years, for better or for worse, or because I've matured or something, I feel more comfortable now with a bigger group than I used to be. So I could see being a little bit bigger. and there's advantages to having, and we have such a large community and community of pretty mature practitioners that holds it all, that we didn't have it back then. It's not just the teachers who have to hold it. So I think that if we had a bigger building that was a little bit bigger than this or something, I think we can manage. But I don't want to become really big. I turned down the opportunity to buy a cathedral. The first congregational church in another part of Redwood City was for sale. And we used that money to buy the retreat center instead, but we were thinking about buying it. But it was just too big, and just the whole dynamics and everything, so I said no. So I think rather than having like a mega IMC someplace, what I really would like to see is us to be a little bit bigger, but also to simultaneously to have more places like this in Mountain View, like Insight Meditation South Bay is thinking about this, and it'd be great if they could have one, and we could have one in San Jose and Belmont, and you know, maybe Belmont's kind of close for now, but eventually, but maybe in San Mateo. And I think there's something very nice about having smaller community meditation centers and the scale of how people relate to each other and the scales of how people participate. And it's a scale that allows for a much easier volunteer system. Once you get a lot bigger and more complex, it can be increasingly hard to have all volunteers. And we really want to keep it this way. So the answer is yes and no. I hope that was not too confusing.
Something I remembered what I forgot long ago. That the whole volunteer aspect also is part of practice here. It brings you into the community. It's often a way to get to know people. It puts you into Dharma community in activity, as opposed to just coming in and sitting and eyes closed. It brings it into practice, and sometimes we have a program once a year or so, the Dharma of Volunteering, or
we've had it now since we had it.
That just addresses this piece, that it's not just about, you know, making the center run, but it's also a part of practice to be in community and engaged with your fellow practitioners to do something together.
Hi, I'm Laura. So I live in LA and spend a lot of time at Insight LA, and they're also experiencing growing pains, and or maybe not pains. But I was wondering, like, there's Insight LA and New York Insight, IMS, Spirit Rock. I was wondering how sort of you work together, communicate around developing the organizations, and also like the development of Buddhism in the West.
Yeah. So those of you who don't know, so kind of what I said before we started, in a sense you can see the beginning was this Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts that began in 1976. And then other centers started to pop up. First Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, I don't know exactly when it started. And then Spirit Rock. And then there were all these satellite sitting groups, they rent a church room or something. And some of them got really big. And now there's probably, I don't know how many centers like ours in the country, but I can think of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's probably at least 12, you know, buildings which are Insight Meditation buildings where they have centers like this now. And that's quite a growth in these years. And each of them has evolved kind of independent of each other. They're each their own nonprofit, their own church, kind of. So there's no legal connection between them. But there's been a lot of attempts over the years to, especially among the teachers, to stay connected. And every 3 years is an international Insight Meditation Teachers gathering that happens either at Spirit Rock, IMS, the Insight Meditation Society, or at Gaia House in England. And so it's a chance for us to see each other at least once every 3 years and, you know, talk about what's going on and learn from each other. The administrative and the organizational aspects of places like Inside LA, that happens, the advice happens more informally because of these friendships that people have. And so, like Trudy Goodman, who's the main teacher there, she'll call different people to consult and ask and for advice. And like she's friends with a lot of people, so it happens more informally. And then some years ago, also kind of coming out of IMC, was the creation of an organization, another nonprofit called the Buddhist Insight Network, BIN for short. And that was an organization whose purpose was to actively be interested in networking and creating connections between all the different communities so they're mutually supportive and a resource for each other. Because all the individual centers are kind of self-involved, you know, they're so busy taking care of themselves that they don't have enough time to really connect and support the wider movement as it grows. And that's been going on for about 5 years, and it's done some great, great work, the Buddhist Insight Network, and people from Inside LA have come to their annual meetings that they have here and other places. But that also requires all volunteers, and that might be a place where we need to transition into a paid staff to really make it work, because it's not a lot of, you know, inspiration about having a, you know, national network and support that, you know, it's very valuable to have it. So we need to have, so now we're trying to, it's kind of not quite dormant, but it's kind of going along much slowly. And that would be there, once it, if that was really strong, it would be there to support places like Insight Ailing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so the Buddhist Insight Network organizes every year, they're going to skip this year, but for the last 5 years, a inter-sangha meeting where people come from not only America, but from Canada and England and from Mexico, have come here to meet with other, like, board presidents and treasurers, and some of the teachers come and do compare notes and how you have centers and teach. And it's a nice thing.
Right now, I would say that every single center has a different model.
Yeah,
you know, it's not there. It all has, and that makes a lot of sense. It's, you know, here it's really inspired by Gil's vision, and in other places, there's the community comes together to do its own thing. There's a community in Sacramento that is teacherless, that really has, you know, created its sangha. And is a very strong community with a lot of senior practitioners, and they invite teachers to come in. So, you know, there's just different models with all of them. And so, you know, it's not that we can say, oh, this is how you do it, but that notion of the Buddhist Insight Network to share information has been really helpful for people.
So we're coming to the end, and so I hope that this gives you a little bit of background perspective of what goes on here and where we fit into the wider Buddhist world, the wider Insight world, and some of the key values and some of the ways in which we are kind of, maybe why we're kind of organized to be kind of casual and relaxed looking about what we do here. But it's all been very carefully thought out, and so we're casual and relaxed about the dana and the money. It's very rare we make a dana talk and asking people, encourage people to make donations or even mention the option to do it. So it looks casual and relaxed, but it's actually a lot of care and thought has gone into that. And a lot of care goes into preserving that as a relaxed, you know, it's a lot of careful attention, nourishing attention has to go to keep it relaxed and kind of casual in this way. So the background of it is maybe it's not so relaxed and casual completely. It's a lot of care and attention to create what we have here. And the consequences of it is that people can come and not quite understand what it's about. But hopefully an evening like tonight, you understand a little bit better what it is. And certainly those of you who would like to be part of this community, we have, by choice, we have no membership. But if you'd like to be a member, you can be. Or if you'd like to be a member, you are. But if you're a kind of person who doesn't like religious groups that has membership, we have no members. whatever suits you. But if you want to be part, please, we hope that we would like everyone who wants to be part of the community, feel intimate and connected to the community in a nice way. Please let us know. Please step forward. I would say this is a very friendly group, so you can, you know, it can be a little intimidating at first, people sitting silently meditating, but please come and be part of it if you like, or in any way that this is a useful place for you, please participate in whatever way is useful for you. We're going to end a couple of minutes early, barely, but I want to introduce to you a little bit more. So, Kate, what happened to Kate Boheim is one of the senior practitioners here and a longtime volunteer, and she has a great volunteer, very important volunteer role of managing all the managers. And so we have a lot of need for managers who can open, take care of. We can't put on events without having a manager.
This is the one who has the combination.
Yeah, she's like the... And you can talk to her a little bit when we finish now about IMC. Hillary has been on the board, has been involved for many years, and is one of the key members as the volunteer coordinator and teaches one of the children's programs and steps in to volunteer all kinds of amazing things that... some of the more reckless people here dream up. And then Liz Powell has also been here for a long time and senior practitioner here, and she now the board president, and So she knows the inside, what really goes on here, better than I do now. So you can talk to her a little bit. And Bruni is here. Bruni has been involved quite a while and does some teaching here now as well. I'm very grateful for her. And she knows how things go on here. And Alfonso has been coming for how many years now? Not that many years, but he
came when I was 18.
And how old are you now?
25.
That's long. That's a long time. Great. And so he's a DARE member, and he knows a little bit the scene here, so you can talk to him, and if you want to ask questions when you finish now. So thank you for coming, and we'll stay here if you want to talk to us and the questions. Please come introduce yourself, and we'll answer whatever we can. Thank you.